flashpoints the corporate press and the linguistic cover-up of Israel's multiple slaughters in Gaza as the apartheid state continues its program of ethnic cleansing in Palestine. We'll be joined by Consortium News Editor-in-Chief Joe Loria and Ray McGovern, recently brutalized and arrested for protesting the fact that the next director of Central Intelligence is probably going to be a pro-torture activist. I'm Dennis Bernstein. All this straight ahead on Flashpoints. Stay tuned. And you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. Delighted to welcome back to these airwaves Joe Loria. He's the new editor-in-chief of Consortium News. He is going to be in town this weekend. For those of you who are in the Bay Area, you might want to meet the new editor of Consortium News as we celebrate the life and times and the great work of Robert Perry, the founder of Consortium News and one of the finest journalists of our time. Joe Loria, welcome back to Flashpoints. I've been looking at your piece about, well, it's called U.S. Media Whitewashes Gaza Massacre, and you deal with the way in which the corporate media feels compelled to cover up the story. And they do it in two ways. It's to neutralize the linguistics and then to blame the victim. Could you please talk a little bit about how you lay that out in your piece?
Sure. Thank you, Dennis, for having me back. I think it's done reflexively. I want to first point out, I don't think they're sitting around at the news meeting and determining what's going on in the paper. Let's cover the story this way. I think this is the way most American reporters have been brought up. This is what they've received from the media, and they're repeating it. Their initial reaction is not to spell it out clearly what happened, and not worry about whose feelings might be hurt about that, just to report that the Israeli soldiers killed 60 people, most of them unarmed, and if they're armed, they had rocks or burning tires or they flew a kite. Yes, some of them went to the fence. It's not clear to me anyway exactly what happened there and whether they got through. They have in the past infiltrated, but The essence of what happened is in a column by Amira Hass in Haaretz this morning, which is extraordinary. It's the Gaza fence that separates the brave from the cowardly. The brave being the Palestinians living in Gaza who've been in an open-air prison, which even the former Prime Minister of Britain, David Cameron, called it an open-air prison. They have withstood two major assaults against them in the last 10 years. There's a blockade, of course, air, land, and sea. You cannot see this other than what David Cameron thought it was. And the brave people are demonstrating anyway, knowing they will be slaughtered, knowing the hospitals cannot take care of all of them, that they've reached that point. They hope the world will notice, is what Amira Hass writes. And there's also, of course, Gideon Levy and Haaretz. Where in the American press do we have any columnists like that? This is the Israeli press. This isn't Israel. We have two columnists regularly writing for this newspaper that say these types of things. They've gotten death threats, apparently. Gideon Levy has. But where in the American press do you see that? Instead, we have what I wrote about, which is this mealy-mouthed, passive way of describing what happened. And I pointed out my article at the beginning because it was on Twitter that I hadn't really been looking at the coverage that had immediately come out, but there were responses from Glenn Greenwald and Max Blumenthal, and quite viciously funny ones, too, actually, about how the coverage was being undertaken by the United States. For example, Max writes, he complained about a CNN headline that said dozens die in Gaza, and he responded, maybe they were old, maybe perhaps they were sick, they just up and died. Who will solve the mystery behind these deaths? And Glenn Greenwald took the New York Times to task for a headline that was, dozens of Palestinians have died in protests as the U.S. prepares to open Jerusalem embassy. And he says that most media outlets in the West have become very skilled through years of practice of writing these kinds of headlines, describing Israeli massacres as in the passive tense to hide the culprit. But the all-time champ, he says, is the New York Times, and hashtag have died. So, this had to be pointed out by them. When I saw this developing, I thought I had to write something about this to pull it together. And that's what I did.
And again, you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. I want to also welcome to these airwaves our good friend, Ray McGovern. Ray had a little run-in during a recent hearing for the next director of Central Intelligence. Apparently, this woman, and I tend not to use her name. I just think of her as the torturer. Ray McGovern, welcome back to Flashpoints. How are you feeling? You took quite a beating there.
Thank you, Dennis. Yeah, I feel rather
restrictions. We're losing you on this phone.
I'm sorry. My left shoulder didn't go out, which was a very major concern. It's a separated shoulder chronically. So, yeah, I'm feeling lucky.
Yeah, ducky, huh? Why did you expect to be thrown around like that and beaten up and then held overnight and taken to central booking for Yeah, go on.
No, I didn't. Like the Gazans that died in Gaza, if you saw the tape, you saw that I fell down. they threw me down on the floor after I got, you know, after they apprehended me, all four of them. Dennis, you'll appreciate this, and Joe too. You've been from you've been in New York. In my day, I would tell people, you should see the other guy.
Well, we saw the other guy. We saw the other guys,
there were
Ray.
Four of them.
And we saw them keep yelling, "Stop resisting! Stop resisting!" And there were monstrosities all over you.
Yeah.
And you're saying, "Excuse me, but that's my arm," and you've moved it to the wrong place.
Yeah, but you know, they'll say I just fell down, and just like the guys, they just died. You know, it's. I wish it were really funny. What happened today is shameful, just shameful, that 10 of that committee voted to approve a torturer, a self-admitted torturer. Well, self-admitted only. See, well, my beef there at the hearing was that Ron Wyden says to her in his last question, Ms. Haspel, were you in charge, were you supervising the waterboarding of Al Nashiri in Thailand? And she says, Senator, that's classified. And I'm saying, my God, you know. And Wyden says, I'm sorry, I'm out of time. But, you know, either he or the chair, Richard Burr, should have said at that point, well, who classified that? And she would have said, well, actually, I did. Yeah. So you've got a person who classified the incriminating evidence that shows beyond any reasonable doubt that she shouldn't be there in the CIA. And that was let stand. So the people watching, if there were a million people watching the hearing, none of them got to know whether she really did that because it's classified by her. I mean, hello. That's when I got up and I said, I'm sorry to interrupt, but Senator Wyden is entitled to a straight answer on that. You all on the panel know what the straight answer is, so of course is Ms. Haspel. So, you know, why doesn't she, my voice was muffled by the four gentlemen that thought that I shouldn't be saying those things.
Well, what were you telling them as they were, besides the fact that they were dislocating your shoulder, you kept talking. What were you telling them?
Well, I was trying to, you know, reach the room there to say that, you know, waterboarding is torture and there's no way to make waterboarding legal. Because, you know, that's what they were all saying, you know, orders to the Justice Department office, let's say, office of whatever it is, said, oh, it's okay. That's Alberto Gonzalez, you know, Bush's lawyer. I mean, nobody thinks that torture is okay. And, you know, when Gonzalez, I followed this really closely at the time, when Gonzalez told Bush that, you know, you don't have to abide by conventions, you have power to just annul that. And so
he was counsel, I believe he was counsel to the president at the time.
That's exactly right. Yeah. So he wrote, or really David Addington, who's more literate and just as Sinister wrote this this 7 February 2002 memorandum, which was an executive order by the president saying, we don't have to abide by the Geneva Conventions, but, quote, we will treat detainees humanely, comma, as appropriate, comma, and as consistent with military necessity, period, end quote. Hello, that's not what Geneva says, and there's no provision in Geneva at all for exceptions such as those. So even Gonzalez was aware of that, and he wrote another member saying, now there may be people in the future that will try to accuse you of violating the convention, but we have artful ways of taking care of that. It's all out there. Those memos are available. So this was a charade, and it really bothers me greatly that Mark Warner, one of my senators here in Virginia, made a little deal so that the incriminating evidence on Gina Haspel, secret as it became since she classified it secret, was not made available to the other senators. Now, we still have to, you know, have the vote in this whole Senate. I still have this forlorn hope that there's enough decency in the American people and that they will be up in arms and go to their senators and say, my God, are you really going to approve a person who is demonstrably guilty of supervising waterboarding and destruction of evidence? My God. So we've reached quite a pass here, and yes, I'm glad I did what I did because nobody else was calling attention to it. But, of course, I didn't make the New York Times.
Well, there were many. You may not have made the New York Times, but there were many people around this country and around the world who took heart, Ray McGarvin. Because I can tell you, it took me about 9 calls to track you down to find out where you were. But once I found out where you were, boy, they knew exactly who you were, and I got the royal treatment. I got more information than I ever got before in my life from a police station or central booking because they wanted to show how, you know, they knew what was going on. You were sort of okay and blah, blah, blah. But clearly the whole world, here's where the phrase comes back and it has meaning. The whole world was watching Ray. Let me bring Joe back into the conversation. I want to guide the conversation towards Consortium News and the significance, how important it is to have alternative news sources in this day of corporate censorship. I now think of it, Joe, as the military-industrial media complex, because the media now is this integral part of the war-making, wouldn't you say?
Yes, I would say that, and as you absolutely correctly said, we need this kind of alternative media more than ever, and they know that, the other side. They're troubled. The entire ruling class, if I could use that phrase, is nervous, and because they feel threatened by the results of the 2016 election on both right and left. There were insurgencies, and some of it is fueled by alternative media on right and left, actually, and this has to stop. Because they're not getting the control that they once had, or at least they still obviously have dominant influence in the corporate media, and they shape the thinking of so many people in our country. But there are inroads being made, and they can't be tolerated. So we've seen efforts by Facebook, by Google, to de-rank various websites, to label them as being paid for by governments. Not that I saw the BBC was labeled as being paid partly by government, but or CBC or any of the others, but of course the enemy is Russia, and whatever anybody says against ruling interests in the United States, corporate or political, cannot come out of our own minds and our own analysis, could not have been in existence in our minds for decades before RT was ever even thought of. But of course it's because we were influenced by Russian propaganda, so that's a very convenient way to tar any kind of journalism. That's the kind we're trying to do with Consortium, and that you do on your show and so many other good sites too. That's not to be tolerated, because we cannot expose or at least question what government is doing in various aspects. And that used to happen with corporate media, at least for a short time in the 70s in particular, when Bob came into journalism, and I shortly after that. We remember that period where it was the journalist's job to ask the tough questions. And there was so much more journalism, too. Many newspapers that have folded, TV stations that have been combined into these huge conglomerates now that dominate everything. And that's why these small, relatively small sites like ours need to survive and to continue to expand, to challenge what government says. That's the job of journalism. It shouldn't be just left up to small websites that Bob Perry created in 1995 because he got fed up with the stories that were being spiked and other suppression of his news. And he opened this space for other journalists who had similar experiences to come write for him. That's how I started writing 16 years after he started. And now we're in charge of this thing. It's a big responsibility, but I feel very committed, obviously, to keep doing what Bob is doing.
You're doing a good job. Now, you mentioned Amara Haas. I had a couple of chances to meet with her and be a part of various forums and stuff. But one of the things that she says, and Amira Haas reports from the West Bank, and she's taken hell. She's been, you could not count on any number of fingers the amount of death threats that she has received for her honest coverage of what happens in the occupied West Bank and in occupied Palestine. But one of the things that she said is my guiding force. And she said, our job as journalists, and I've said this before, but it means everything to me. Our job as journalists is to monitor the centers of power and report back to the people. Now, the Fourth Estate has become the First Estate. They like to sit with the power class and feel like they're a part of it.
No question about it. As I wrote in that piece you referred to at the very end, when you've been pushing the same line that's gotten you very far in the pecking order of the media business, and you've not stepped on the toes that you can't step on, you're not going to suddenly change overnight and start reporting clearly that Israel shot and killed 60 mostly unarmed people. That's just not, you're not able to do that, shift gears that quickly, because you've been used to that. That's what got you where you were, and you know what you have to do. And so you don't look at it in that way. And this is an enormous cover-up, basically, of a horrendous crime that we've seen here. And it is part of the establishment and the way that Nikki Haley at the Security Council tried to say that Israel had shown great restraint in a massacre that belongs in the annals of the massacres of colonialism, the British in India, et cetera, think something like that. That's how you have to view this. But it's excused by a media that's supposed to report the facts. That doesn't happen.
That's the voice.
Yeah,
go on, Ray.
Reminded me of the Great Salt March, you know?
Yes.
Those are people gunned down or beaten down with batons. I'd like to just very briefly interject to what we in the Bronx call a for instance. Okay, so here's a for instance. I don't have much contact with journalists, but when I did face down Rumsfeld way back in, 2006, and I showed him up to be a liar about weapons of mass destruction and ties with Al-Qaeda, I'm walking out of this think tank, and I get a call. And it's, hello, this is Anderson Cooper. Hey, Ms. McGovern, you're creating quite a stir down here. I'd like to have you in my program, but first I'd like to ask you this. And I said, sure, Anderson. Weren't you, weren't you afraid? I was in some shock at myself, and I thought that was a normal question. I said, well, no, actually, I have a brief defense. But then I said, wait a second. This is Anderson Cooper, Eric Vanderbilt, pretty boy. And he's asking me, wasn't I afraid? So I said, Anderson, let me just fuck with you.
We're losing you, Ray. Ray, can you turn your body around because we're losing your
sure,
signal?
Okay. I said, Anderson, I look at this as an incredible opportunity because here I am. I've done my homework. I know that he had to lie and answer to these questions or be asked them all, answer them all. And so, Anderson, let me give you a suggestion. Do your homework. Ask real questions, and you'll find it's a real high when you're finished.
He says, oh, well, all right, Mr. McGovern. Well, I'll have my people get in touch with your family.
No, Anderson, no.
I don't have any people. Please, just call me back.
Don't,
it was a bizarre. It was surreal.
I don't have any people.
Weren't you afraid? God. And this guy's not going to be out on the streets of Atlanta with his hat, right?
Listen, let me say this. I want to say this again because I have not done a due diligence to let people know that there is going to be a fantastic celebration in honor of Robert Perry. We're going to greet the new editor. Joe Laurie is going to be in town with Bob's son, Sam Perry, who is a co-founder of Consortium News. I'm going to be there. Norman Solomon's going to be there. A whole bunch of people are going to be there. We're going to be at Sita and Benita at the Favorite People's Church, the UU Universal... what. the Universal
Unitarians.
Thank you. I'm getting too old for this. But it's at Sita Bonita in Berkeley. It's on Saturday. It's at 2 o'clock. Get there, join us. It's going to be spectacular, and I am hoping that you will pack the place to honor the work of Robert Perry, help us greet the new editor, and learn a lot about journalism as well. So I want to make sure you know this is happening this Saturday at 2 o'clock, 2 p.m. It's at 1924 Cedar Street in Berkeley. 1924 Cedar Street in Berkeley. We want you to please join us let's share something about journalism. I love, by the way, in your piece, you include, Joe, this amazing quote from, the former defense minister of Israel, Moshe Dayan. And Moshe Dayan, you alluded to this earlier, that if you see the newspapers, if you read the newspapers in Israel, if you read Amir Ahas, you're going to learn a hell of a lot more about the nature of occupation than if you read 10 U.S. newspapers, listen to CNN and MSNBC. In fact, that would be minus learning. But this quote here is so powerful from Moshe Dayan. And he says, quote, the former defense minister in the 50s says, what cause have we to complain about their fierce, he's talking about the Gazans and the Palestinians. What cause have we to complain about their fierce hatred of us? For 8 years now, they sit in their refugee camps in Gaza, and before their eyes, we turn into our homestead, the land and villages in which they and their forefathers have lived. He went on, you say, we are a generation of settlers, and without the steel helmet and gun barrel, we shall not be able to plant a tree or build a house. Let us not be afraid to see the hatred that accompanies and consumes the lives of hundreds of thousands of Arabs who sit all around us and wait for the moment when their hands will be able to reach our blood. Wow. You're not going to read that in the New York Times, are you, Joe?
I have never read that in the New York.
I haven't seen it there. I haven't seen it in the Wall Street Journal. You wrote for them, too. Did they ever do anything like this?
No, they took out references I made to 130 countries recognizing Palestine in stories about the vote coming up at the General Assembly to make them an observer state. No, they would not put this quote in there.
They censored you on those stories.
Well, it was, I would say, suppressed because...
Suppressed, okay.
Taken out before it was published.
Oh, that's right. It was an edit. Let's just say it was an edit for space.
It was an edit for space. Yeah, right.
How many times have you heard that? We just need to get three lines out, and we know which ones we want.
Before the internet, it was certainly more because there really was space restrictions in a newspaper. But Moshe Dayan, by the way, Ray shouldn't get all the credit here. I'm from the Bronx, too. He was just saying...
All right.
New York.
All right. All right.
Come on. But Dayan was a real tough guy. I remember growing up in the Bronx, watching him on TV, the dashing defense minister of Israel with that eye patch. He was cut quite a figure in the American media at the time. He was a character. And here he is laying out the truth as he saw it. He's not mincing words at all. He's saying, don't be surprised if they're going to hate us because we're stealing their land. This is the key thing here. We've turned, our homestead is based on their land and villages, which they and their forefathers have lived on. So all this rubbish about a people without a land, you know, people without a land, taking in a country without people, is all rubbish. And he's saying it's rubbish right there. He's saying it clearly. But he's like Benny Morris and as opposed to Ilan Popper. But they both say that there was ethnic cleansing. They list the villages that were destroyed and the enormous amount of violence that was used to clear Palestinians out. Benny Morris thinks it was good, and Ilan Pop doesn't. And that's exactly what we got here with Moshe Dayan. He's saying he agrees with it. I mean, we're a settled nation. He's not ashamed of that. This is how we're going to build Israel, and that, unfortunately, there's going to be a lot of innocent victims here, and they're going to hate our guts, and we've got to be prepared for that. But, you know, he was with the project. At least he was being honest about it. And instead of this propaganda we've gotten ever since that there was, you know, Israel was innocent, and they did nothing to earn the hatred of the Palestinians that exist until today, and they're still in that refugee camps in Gaza, and they're angrier than they could have been even back then, 61 years later. So how could we be surprised by the reaction, by marching to a fence, tens of thousands of people, and then to be mowed down and picked off by snipers while the American embassy is being opened in Jerusalem at the same time with a grinning Netanyahu. I mean, you can't really make this up. This is just was an extraordinary day in the history, really, of Israel.
You know, positions to things.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, Joe, I agree more. And let me exercise my prerogative of being older than both of you. When I was 8 years old, right next to the war, it was the Nakba. It was the Israeli foundation of the Israel state. Now, in the Bronx, we had great rejoicing. 30% of my neighborhood were Jewish people. We were all overjoyed that Jews would have their homeland. Nobody ever told us. Nobody ever told us that there were people already there.
That there were
like
people living
there. For a millennium, right? Nobody told us that over 700,000 people driven from their homes ended up in places like Gaza. My God. And the other thing is this. When we talk about the Six-Day War in 1967, there's the USS Liberty.